Paula Harris is an Italo-American photojournalist, investigative reporter in the field of extraterrestrial-related phenomena research. Now, she has a master's degree in education, teaches history and photojournalism at the American Overseas School of Rome. Paula has written numerous national publications and has been a speaker at several UFO conferences. She has studied extraterrestrial-related phenomena since 1979 and is on personal terms with many of the leading researchers in the field. She has also interviewed many top military witnesses concerning their involvement in the government truth embargo. Hello, Paula. How are you? Welcome back.
Well, thank you, George. It's great to be back. Here I am calling from Rome, and they tell me I sound like I'm next door.
I hope you didn't call collect, Paula.
No.
You do sound. The quality coming out of there is fantastic tonight. It really is. How have you been? What have you been doing?
Well, I'm still teaching, and I'm on my way back to the United States for Christmas. I can't wait to come back to the States. On the 18th, I come back for 3 weeks. And as far as in the ufology field or the exopolitical field, if we want to call it that, I'm doing an awful lot. I'm doing a lot of stories. I've just done one major conference in Florence where we had Linda Moulton Howe as a special guest. So Linda and I got to exchange some information. Of course, you know, we had Richard Hoagland here in November, and you know, we have a lot of things going on here in Europe.
Well, I'm looking forward to tonight's chat with you, Paula. Dr. Michael Sala is a pioneer in the development of exopolitics. He's the author of Exopolitics, Political Implications of the Extraterrestrial Presence. In addition, he has authored 4 other books, more than 70 articles, chapters, and book reviews on peace, ethnic conflict, and conflict resolution. Dr. Sala was an assistant professor, researcher, and residence in the School of International Service at the American University up until 2004. He has a PhD in government from the University of Queensland, Australia, and an MA in philosophy from the University of Melbourne, Australia. Dr. Sala's website, which is exopolitics.org, has to date scored more than 7 million hits and continues to attract great interest from those seeking to understand the big picture about the undisclosed extraterrestrial presence and its political implications. And I notice, Michael, that we say here that you were an instructor at the American University, so I take it that our email campaign to get you to continue your tenure there did not work, or did they at least realize what they were doing to you?
Oh, hi, George. Well, yes, it certainly was helpful to just bring to the attention of the university the importance of exopolitics, but as I thought would be the case, that the university eventually decided to side with the department that wanted to basically terminate my association because simply they weren't ready for any of their researchers to be actively engaged in exopolitics topics.
But
I've relocated now, and I'm quite happy with where I am.
I was going to say, you're on to bigger and better things, Michael, and that's the important thing. Both of you, you can just jump in at any time as we continue this discussion tonight about UFOs and their presence and what governments would do if they have to disclose to us. Paula, the last time, as you know, we talked to you, you were covering that Mars conference out there trying to find out what was happening with the Italian scientist who was going to tell us about whether there was life on Mars or not. Since then, there have been some reports from scientists who are really warning us to be careful about what we bring back from Mars, from our astronauts, if we ever get there, and spaceships and the like, because they're concerned about Martian contamination here on this planet, which to me is almost an admission that there's life out there. But what do we hear from, was it Formisano? Was that his last name?
Yeah, the Formisano. Well, Formisano, when I spoke to him personally, told me that he was not going to allow any interviews and did not want me to contact him until after he had done the Nature magazine article. And from what I understand, they were still reviewing the article from Nature magazine. I think it's ever so important also in academia for these people to publish first, because then it becomes kind of legitimatized, and I think that's what he was waiting for. And the minute that that comes out, the minute that that's published, since he's right here in Rome, I will be right at his door, and Richard and I will be able to bring you an update. Because if Formisano, as an Italian, is the first one to come out with this you know, chemical analysis mm-hmm. through the spectrometer that there is methane, a gas on Mars, and so forth, then we need to bring this forth. But right now we're just waiting. Everybody is waiting with bated breath. The thing that gets me, though, George, is why are we waiting for chemical analysis? Why are we waiting for these things? We have to do it scientifically when we know for sure. I think we almost have enough evidence with the Richard Hoagland's work that there has been some kind of civilization on Mars, and also from the NASA pictures. It's almost like we're going backwards, because I think there's a lot of people admit that we have had some kind of real evidence that there has been some kind of civilization on Mars. So, you know, here I am as a researcher going, okay, we'll play this game. We'll have it be that the scientific thing comes out, and then we admit it.
Well,
it's very frustrating.
Paula, right before both of you came on, read the story of a 7-year-old Russian boy who knows more about space than most astronomers, and he claims he was from Mars, and he explains that they had a catastrophe, they lost their atmosphere, and that some inhabitants who remain still live at least underground. It's an amazing story.
Well, yeah, but, you know, it isn't. It's amazing because we're not used to thinking in this way.
Exactly.
But if we would realize that Mars possibly, and quite possibly, was inhabited, and maybe we've had some connection with Mars, and I've been told that by several witnesses, then, I mean, we'll get used to this thinking that it's not so outrageous. But that, you know, that maybe is coming up. I don't know with this acclimation process.
Well, let's get into our exopolitics in the presence here. Dr. Michael Sala, first of all, give us a little definition difference between ufology and exopolitics. What's really the difference?
Well, ufology really does deal with that empirical side of the whole phenomenon of UFOs, looking at the material evidence and being able to test it, being able to have different laboratory analysis done on that and various examinations of whatever photographic or film evidence exists and be able to reach some sort of conclusion about how real this phenomenon is. Whereas exopolitics moves beyond that. It basically starts with the premise that the evidence suggesting that extraterrestrials are here is overwhelming, that the general public are looking for real guidance into exactly what are the political processes underlying that. And so exopolitics really begins to look at the key actors, the institutions, the processes that all are involved with the cover-up of ETs and the various government agreements that make that possible.
Okay, and you back off your phone, Michael, if you would, just a little bit, because you're popping a little bit when you talk, okay, if you can. Let's, for this discussion this evening, let's make the assumption that we've been visited, we are being visited, that they are here. And let's create a discussion, Paula, around that. The fact that all this has been going on, when do we get the disclosure that so many people have been calling for or predicting? When does it happen?
It's happening, I think, right now. I mean, you started by talking about the difference between exopolitics and ufology. Ufology has done the groundwork. I mean, we have so many sightings, we don't need to go on and on and on with the sightings and the close encounters of the second kind and the physical traces cases. And my friend Alan Hynek did a good job putting together all the research on this. I think what Michael's done, and thank God Michael's come on the scene, is talked about the actual contact. Okay, we know this is real. We know this has happened. And I think later on, George, we can talk about some actual cases.
Absolutely.
Because I'd like to talk about the Billy Meyer case.
Sure.
And the Charles Hall case. We know this has happened. We know that there are extraterrestrials. We know there's been meetings. We know we've hosted some of them. We know this is happening. Now, what are the implications for planet Earth? I think that what Michael is doing is bringing this one step further out to think about the implications, which is what I think I'm interested in as an educator. Now, some people may be interested in how the thing works and the technology, and we want the technology and the propulsion system. But as a sociologist, as an educator, as educators, because we're both in education, both Michael and I are in education, we're wondering what the implications for our children, our children's children's children are, and we're wondering what this actually means. I'm going to be writing an article calling Taking Ufology Out of the Dark Ages, because if we remain only on sightings and we remain only on contact or abductions and we remain only there, we're never going to get anywhere. But you asked me a question about when's this going to happen? It's happening tonight.
Well,
I think it's happening every time you get some people that come forth, like in the case of Charles Hall, like in the case of Billy Meyer, like in the case of Clifford Stone, like in the case of Colonel Corso. Every time these people come out and tell the truth, you are adding pieces to the puzzle. You are getting a clear picture because these people are credible witnesses. And then the people that want to will put it together.
Well, see, I want to see a United Nations or a presidential statement, something from the White House or from the UN on a dark, eerie night where they come out and they make this announcement. To me, that's when full disclosure really occurs. I mean, we will have witness testimony and whistleblowers, but I want to see our government leaders come forward and say, here, this is what's going on. And to me, Paula, there's several reasons why that might not have occurred yet. One is they really have this, and I don't know which it is, but they really have this belief that there could be worldwide panic. The second is the loss of control, you know, when all of a sudden we earthlings believe that there's a another group that is a little more intelligent than we are or sophisticated. We may not want to listen to governments. We may want to listen to the extraterrestrials. Another possible reason, these extraterrestrials could be harming us. They could be experimenting on us, and they're, again, that's part of the panic. And then the other reason, I thought, Paula, was the possibility that if we were told that they're there, then our question would be, then why aren't you giving us the technology, the cheaper energy, or the cleaner energy, or the freer energy? And that's another possibility. Or it could be all of the above. What do you think, Paula?
It's all of the above, George. You just hit the whole gamut of reasons. I think anybody that is intelligent that's trying to figure this out, it's all of the gamut. All everything you're telling me, the only thing that I'm thinking of is maybe the disclosure will not be in the hands of the government. Maybe the disclosure will be given to the people, and maybe the agenda is in the hands of the ET. But I think we should ask Michael about this.
Absolutely. And Michael, again, with those reasons, do you believe it's all of the above as well?
Definitely all of those, and I think what we do need to understand about disclosure is that it's not an event, one single announcement by a government agency or politician. It's actually a process, and what helps us understand a disclosure process is that along that process there are many points at which the government or those who are in control of the disclosure process can evaluate the reaction of the general public. So they can get someone like Philip Corso to come forward, release his memoirs, and see what the reaction is. They can get other whistleblowers like Clifford Stone to give their testimonies. And again, they sit back and look at the reactions. And this way, by allowing or encouraging whistleblowers, former employees to come forward, give disclosure of their experiences, what the government is able to do is get feedback as to where exactly the government is and how where the general population is and how quickly they need to move on this acclimation. Now, of course, they're moving very slowly for the reasons that you cited, and I think that this new case that Paula has done the groundbreaking research on, which is Charles Hall, is just one more example of another whistleblower coming forward with some pretty startling revelations, and that is part of this disclosure process.
This goes back a long way, Michael. I remember we talked about a year ago, and you were beginning to discuss the fact that Eisenhower at the time had a meeting, you believed, with extraterrestrials, correct?
That's correct, yes. In February 1954, President Eisenhower did make a secret trip to Edwards Air Force Base and met with, according to a number of alleged testimonies, some extraterrestrials, and that began a process which ultimately led to agreements with those extraterrestrials that the government has been working with in terms of developing technologies.
I had an opportunity a month ago to talk with Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell, who said that he believes that we've been visited and he thinks the evidence is here that we've been visited. And, Michael, when you hear that coming from a person like that that you respect, as far as I'm concerned, you have to believe it to be. And we need more people like Mitchell to come forward like that, don't we?
Exactly. I think people like Mitchell and many of the whistleblowers all have bits of a huge puzzle, and I think that's the challenge for those of us who are doing the investigations and the analysis, is try to piece together the different parts of the puzzle that these people come forward and release, because one thing you do learn pretty quickly is that the whole ET phenomenon is compartmentalized very heavily, so anyone coming forward can only give a little bit of the picture, so that it's up to investigators to try to piece all this together to get the broad picture of what's going on. And Edgar Mitchell is one of those that does provide a key part of that puzzle.
What's so amazing, too, is if you counted up all the people just in this country who have had just incredible UFO eyewitness accounts, it would probably be staggering. And I have not seen a UFO yet. I'd love to. But I believe that there are millions of people in this country who have seen UFOs, who have reported UFOs, that they're, you know, dedicated Americans, hardworking people, policemen, teachers, doctors, who knows, truck drivers, plumbers. It doesn't matter whatever educational scheme or socioeconomics or how much money you make. The fact is you're a person of intelligence and reason, and there are a lot of people out there, Michael, who have seen these things.
Exactly, and according to the 2002 Roper poll, approximately 70% of the American population believe that ETs are real and that the government is hiding that. So what we are aware of now is that the sightings phenomenon, the number of people who have had some kind of direct experience is so vast that people do believe that this is very real and that a cover-up is underway. So I think that's really why exopolitics is such an exciting field to be in, because the general public are looking to go beyond the question of proof that this is real. They know it's real, and they're wanting some information about what's happening behind the scenes.
Michael, mention your website, would you? While we have a moment here?
Sure. The Exopolitics website, exopolitics.org, that focuses on the phenomenon concerning the government cover-up, and it tries to put together as much credible evidence that this cover-up has been underway for over 50 years and that there is a lot of whistleblower, contactee, and other testimony that helps us understand exactly what's been going on.
And all the websites, of course, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Paula, your website is kind of a long one. You want to give that out?
No, well, actually, it's Paola. It's www.paola. It's Italian. PAOLAHARRIS.IT for Italy. And, George, I was going to add something to the Edgar Mitchell situation, too. I also spoke to Edgar Mitchell at Roswell. I did a really great interview with him, which I'm going to be placing on my website. And he's wonderful as far as being one of the people that speaks about this. But he, too, is just alluding to it. What we are looking at, though, if you look at Grant Cameron's work, and that's on my website, is the presidential involvement in the ET presence, and that meeting at Edwards is discussed in detail in Grant Cameron, and he's a Canadian investigator's
right.
work. And this is an example of investigators getting together and putting together this puzzle and the research. Now,
Hold the story until we come back, okay, Paula? And then we'll also talk about Charles Hall as well. We'll be right back with Paula Harris, Dr. Michael Sala, right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norton as we talk about the political implications of extraterrestrials. Paula, you wanted to tell us a quick story right before the break. Go ahead.
Right. If you look at the Holloman meeting or the Eisenhower meeting, it was in 1954. We are exactly 50 years after that. We're coming up on February. I think that what happened there was that we were given 50 years to get people ready for this kind of contact. So I'm not surprised that something like the Charles Hall story comes out and Carnal Corso and a lot of other stories come out. But the story I wanted to tell you was it goes back to Clifford Stone. Clifford Stone, as people know, was involved in crash retrievals. And I happened to be filming at Clifford Stone's house in Roswell, and there was this canister there with this very old label on it, and I didn't notice. I filmed the canister and all the other microfilm and stuff he had on the table, and I sent it back to my office in Italy, and my publisher called me right away, my editor, and said, did you know what you just filmed? That canister read Holloman Accord, the Holloman meeting, and you didn't even ask Clifford Stone to see that. And so I was very embarrassed because at that time I didn't have a background. When I asked Clifford Stone later on about that canister that he had, he said he had 6 minutes of that, and he described what was on that. So this is kind of a reality. He described that because it makes sense that there would have been some kind of meeting with extraterrestrials. Also, that's why some film like Close Encounters, which is talking about a meeting, would come out in 1978 or so. Because these are the ways that the government, if you want to call it the government, but let's remember the government changes. We get different presidents, different senators, and so forth. I prefer to call it the military. These are the ways that the military comes out with acclamation. So, the fact that this is 50 years later and we're getting a few stories and you want me to talk about the Charles Hall case, I know, is absolutely normal for the way I look at it as a researcher.
Let's talk about Charles Hall, and we'll get Dr. Michael Sala's input on that, too. Who is Charles Hall, Paula?
Okay, Charles James Hall is a weather observer that worked on the Nellis base, out of Indian Springs from 1965 to 1967. He's written 3 books called Millennial Hospitality with the help of his wife who edited the books. And these books, you can buy them and they come out as science fiction. But when I met him in Roswell in July of 2003, I happened to sit and talk to him. And when he was telling me the details of these books, he happened to say to me that they were true. And I said, oh, goodness, well, this is about an alien race of tall whites. They are about between 7 and 8 feet high, live to be 800 years old. And these tall people, very thin people, were hosted on the Nellis base from 1965 to 67. And he talks about his meeting them, his interacting with them. And the thing that amazed me the most about these books and about this story is that they had their children with them. So as he was telling me this in Roswell, and you know, very few people found it, it is very hard for people to actually digest this material, I thought, well, let me see if he can give me some documents that says he was on the Nellis base.
Right.
Let me see if I can find some other weather observers that say that he was on the Nellis base. Let me see if I can research this case. A year and a half later, here I am to tell you that, yes, Charles James Hall was working as a weather observer on the Nellis base. Yes, we have, thanks to people that have helped us, investigators that have helped us, gotten other weather observers who worked with him. And yes, from what he tells us, there were tall, white, alien beings, so we think of them as alien, but I think of them as people anymore, who are hosted on the base with a technology transfer. The technology transfer happened to be part of the deal. They could stay on the base provided they were, they could not, you know, go off the base without, accompaniment. And his story is amazing because it deals with also children, with families. Now, Clifford Stone had told me a long time ago that we were hosting families on Earth. So what I was getting was what Clifford Stone had told me a long time ago.
You mean extraterrestrial families?
The extraterrestrial families, that it's absolutely normal. This, according to these tall whites, and I don't know what else to call them, is a way station. And it's absolutely normal that we would have Earth as a way station. The thing is, though, that since they come and go, they needed to be in a place where it was contained. And when Charles Hall tells his story, and there's so many details to this story, He says they were accompanied by American military. He said officers. He said colonels. He said people. He said he saw these whites being accompanied by the military. He said he saw the mothership that was inside a hangar in the mountain there near Indian Springs. On my website is an actual design of where the hangar was, where the range was that Charles worked. He worked in range 3 and 4. And I've got to add, George, that it's been a year and a half, and what I did is I worked with this story with an airlines pilot, a commercial airlines pilot from New Zealand. His name is David Coote, because I thought I was going crazy. I thought, well, I've got to work on this with another person that is really, you know, going to look at this objectively. And David has agreed, and I have agreed, that this is a true story. So we flew Charles Hall to Indian Springs this summer in June and had him recount his entire story. We were outside the Indian Springs area as far as there is a barbed wire fence that leads you to Dreamland in Area 51. So we were outside the barbed wire fence, and Charles relived and recapped everything that happened with his interaction with these tall whites to the detail, and he's not making it up. So David Coote, who is the other investigator, and I, and this story is on my website, have concluded that for sure, and listen to the dates, 1965 to 67, we were hosting extraterrestrials and their families on the Nellis base. Now, Michael Sala has talked to Charles Hall, so you might want to ask him his impression.
I will do that, but now the extraterrestrials he describes, I mean, were they human form even though they were 8 feet tall?
Well, he said that the older they grew, the older they were, the taller they grew. They're very human. He said the women look like Twiggy. They look like the model Twiggy,
right?
Because he said they were their heads were supported by a very thin neck, very humanoid, wore clothes, regular clothes. He said the children wore clothes that he assumed came from the Sears catalog. They wore regular clothes. Children looked normal, except that they had hair that was transparent. He said it was almost like it was transparent blonde. Their eyes were, he said, wraparound eyes. If you can imagine that, they were blue. When he first saw the first one, he saw what he thought was an animal in a big sagebrush. And he got close to this sagebrush. He looked down, and this little girl turned around and faced him. And he said she had paper white skin. This scared him. It would scare anybody.
Oh, yeah. First of all, you'd think it was a ghost.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And he said they've been around a long time and has been interpreted as ghosts, because he said the legend in that valley was that there was a ghost horse named Range 4 Harry. They named this ghost horse. And what had happened was when they float, and they had floating equipment to come up from the valley, he said it was just equipment. He said they would float up with their suits that would have some kind of electronics which would spit out a kind of a reflective material. He said in the night it looked like a ghost. And he said there's so many stories. In fact, the one witness that we finally got after 40 years said, yes, there was this ghost, and it looks like a ghost from far away. When you have four people, you know, together that are floating, it looks like some kind of animal. And this legend had been going on for a long time, that there was this floating ghost. Now, Charlie got to see them close up, so he knows that they had these suits that could allow them to move, and he also knows that they had equipment in order to communicate. So when he saw the child, he understood it was a non-human child, backed away, and beside her was the mother, and he understood right away that he was not to interfere at all, and just was very, you know, and asked the child, do you need help? Have you lost your mother, and so forth. Had a mental conversation with the child. Now, when this happens, and if this is a true story, this is where exopolitics comes in. What do you do? What does anyone do when they have a situation like this? So this story is so important because of the way Charlie interacted. It was a protocol, and I think protocol is ever so important to discuss.
All right, Michael, what do you think of Charles Hall?
Well, I did find him to be very credible when I spoke to him. He speaks with great integrity and sincerity. He describes experiences that altered his life, and one does feel that this was very real for him. And what I found in the books was that this was a very unusual experience. Contrary to a lot of other whistleblowers who are bound by security oaths and not wanting to reveal classified information that would get them into trouble in their retirement, Charles Hall wasn't in any way constrained by those types of classification or security oaths in any way. He related that as a weather observer, he wasn't bound at all, as are others who may have access to extraterrestrials. He basically had free range over the territory where the tall whites frequented. He was able to interact with them. He was able to talk about his experiences with anyone if he chose to do so, and he wasn't in any way constrained by any kind of regulations as to exactly what it was he could reveal later on. So what we have in his memoirs are three volumes of very detailed descriptions of the encounters he had with these tall white extraterrestrials. And what I find to be very revealing from an exopolitical aspect was he talked at length about the interactions that he had where you had Air Force generals and other senior officials present with the tall whites, where they were interviewing Charles Hall, or where they were observing the interaction between the tall whites and Charles Hall. So it was like, as far as the US Air Force was concerned, this was a way in which they could see how ordinary servicemen who hadn't been briefed on the extraterrestrial presence would interact with the tall whites. And the kind of reaction that Charles had and the other servicemen who served there on the Nellis base, I think, was part of a process that the secret government was using to be able to determine exactly how the general public would respond to this disclosure.
Why don't we slap a lie detector test on this guy and see what it comes up?
Well, I think personally that he certainly would be able to do quite well given the kind of responses he gave when I spoke to him. He comes across as completely sincere, with great integrity, but I'm certainly not the person to speak to him about a lie detector. I mean, Paola knows him much better than I, and she or Charles may have to talk about whether that would be something that he would be willing to do.
I mean, would he do that, Paola? And willing to pay for it.
He would be. I'm sure he would be willing to do that. And I think maybe in a later show you could get him to come on, and your listeners could ask him questions too. He's very willing to do it. And Michael has covered one very important issue: the fact that he is able to talk. And when I started doing this story in 2003, it kept saying, "Charlie, why are you allowed to say this? Why are you allowed to tell me this story? Why am I allowed to investigate this right down to the detail?" Because we really went through everything in his story. David Coote and I did an incredible job going through every detail in his story. And he said this. He said, "I was never told that I couldn't." He said that the tall whites had said to the government that Charlie is free to do and talk as he wished. So my assumption was this was an ET decision. And if it's an ET decision, in other words, if it's a tall white decision that this one man that was able to really interact with them in a calm and civilized way could talk about it, then that's one of the reasons maybe Charles could be a spokesman for this. Because evidently he had no security restrictions. And he has been speaking about this. I mean, I just did an interview with him on another radio station. He is able to talk about it without, and he's had no repercussions. Yes, he would do a lie detector test, just as Travis Walton did a lie detector test
and
for
passed.
His experience.
And passed.
But, you know, I know Travis really well. Travis and I are really good friends. And he said in spite of his doing a lie detector test, he's had all kinds of problems.
Well, I know that, but, you know, I think any whistleblower who is prepared to take a lie detector test, whether it's inconclusive or not, at least is telling people who would listen to him, "I've got nothing to hide." And to me, that's dramatic, that's important, and I would support that individual. Even though, you know, if the results were inconclusive, you know, as opposed to a direct lie, let's say, I would support that person and give him as much backing as he needed in order to get his word out. Because, you know, those kinds of people don't come around very often. I mean, Dan Bursch, for example, we've offered, and he's nowhere to be found. His mother, apparently, who has called the program, hasn't talked to him in 10 years, for crying out loud. So I don't think he'll ever take one. But, I mean, if Charles Hall would take one, and we could arrange it somewhere with you there, Paula, with the results given then on Coast to Coast with Hall, I think that's pretty darn dramatic.
Yeah, I don't know how exactly that is put together because I don't know the logistics of that. Yes, it is pretty dramatic. And the fact that Charles would paint this group of people as a people with whom humans can interact, who have children and are people that we don't need to be afraid of. In other words, they're a civilization of people, somewhat like ours. I think is will also lead to the amount of research we're doing as a type of ETs that are visiting, and we'll get away from the gray scenario where everybody's been sitting for I don't know how many years with these hostile grays and so forth. I think that the example of the tall white scenario that Charles is coming forth will change the perspective of the visitations we're having. I'm positive. You know, when David Coot and I flew Charles Hall to Indian Springs, and we had to take him to where he worked, close to where he worked. Of course, you can't get on the Nellis base. But when we took him there, he recalled details that you wouldn't believe. And we had a video there when we were doing this. And the man has really lived every single second of that which he tells in his books. For me, it's astounding. It's probably the most astounding story that's come out. And I'm sure he'd be willing to collaborate
right.
this material.
I'll let you work that out with him. Maybe we could fly him and you to Los Angeles. I could get some friends at the LAPD, those polygraph experts. We could hook him up and then bring him right into the studio that night.
Yeah, that would be great. One of the people that is working with us that found that extra witness that he mentions in his book was with LAPD. He is a person that has listened to your show, George, believe it or not, and contacted me. So you have listeners at the LAPD.
Oh, no, I know that. Believe me.
He contacted me and he asked me how I could help, and I said, find this witness. We've been trying for a year to find this particular person, and he found him. And I think that if you have this kind of help from LAPD and other resources, we can get to the truth.
Absolutely. And I think that would be a worldwide story, Paula, especially with someone who has the inside and know-it-all. I mean, that would be, to me, one of the greatest stories of the century. And, you know, assuming he passes, tells you all kinds of things, all our suspicions. Michael Sala, that things that we have known may come true, huh?
Well, I think he just reveals so much about the way in which the government has worked closely with extraterrestrials. It fills in a lot of the gaps that we were trying to work out in terms of how the government would work with ETs in exchanging technology, what sort of reciprocal rights were given, what happened when the ETs were based here. And, for example, he talks about the families. He talks about, Charles Hall talks about the way in which the servicemen interacted with the tall whites and the kind of behavior that the tall whites had.
Let's talk about the evidence when we come back, Michael, because so many people are saying, okay, come on now, show us the evidence. And Paula will also talk about the Billy Meyer case when we come right back. He, of course, is the person who had those incredible videos and movies from Switzerland and still pictures as well. I'll be back. So, Dr. Michael Sala, are other countries being visited? Are they sharing technology with them, or are we just the fortunate ones here?
Well, other countries are definitely being visited and monitored by extraterrestrials. There are numerous sightings in other countries. There's also reports of crashed disks in other countries, which are relocated to the United States using specialist teams comprising servicemen such as Clifford Stone, who did speak about his work doing that, and that involved traveling to other countries that were cooperating with the U.S. in the retrieval of these craft. And what that suggests is that while extraterrestrial races may be visiting other countries, that as far as the reverse engineering of the technology is concerned, most of that happens here, and that any agreements with extraterrestrials, that is worked through the United States. And I think that that was something that was set up very early on in the post-war era. We're talking immediately after the Second World War, when it became clear that extraterrestrials were visiting, that the major governments of the planet were able to set up some kind of system whereby they would work together to ensure that this technology from extraterrestrials would be used in the most responsible way, and that no agreements would be reached between extraterrestrials and any other countries aside from the major powers such as the U.S.
Because the Germans were so advanced during World War II, rocketry and everything else, I have always thought that they probably had some kind of extraterrestrial intervention or something, or they found a craft. What do you think, Michael?
Definitely. There's a number of former German scientists, Werner von Braun.
Yep.
And Hermann Oberth, who talked about Germany having had help in their reverse engineering or in the development of these advanced technologies. And even Philip Corso talked about how the Nazis did have ET technology in their possession, just as the US had, and that the Nazis had the same problems in terms of developing or reverse engineering the advanced propulsion system that the extraterrestrials had, that it was somehow activated by mental thoughts of the extraterrestrials themselves. So definitely the Nazis were very heavily involved with extraterrestrials.
Paula, let's talk about the Billy Meyer case, of course. He's the person from Switzerland who, over the years, has just taken some incredible UFO pictures, staggering, quite frankly. What's new there?
Well, I went to visit the Billy Meyer and the group up in Schmidt-Rudy in Switzerland. It's about 23 miles outside of Zurich last June. And one of the reasons I went there, too, is because I was very interested in the Pleiadian messages. And now we got to look at the situation that the Pleiadians, like the Tall Whites, are people. They're very much like us. They resemble us. So I was curious. And when I went there, the first thing that you know, struck me was where Billy lives, that acreage where he lives, is very unusual. There are plants and trees and shrubbery growing there that's absolutely amazing. I've never seen anywhere else. They explained to me later that one of the reasons why the crafts had picked that place where to land was because it had a very particular frequency. It had a very particular vibration. So when I was walking towards, you know, his house, and I saw all this, I said, I can understand. Now, I spoke to the people around Billy. Although Billy, who has very advanced telepathic ability, knew we were there. There were four of us, and we had gone on a Sunday afternoon, and we were talking with the people around Billy, and they said they were doing a peace meditation at 3:00, and since it was in German, would we mind not, going down a little bit farther to a meditation garden and waiting? And while we were waiting for them to finish the peace meditation, all at once we look up, and there's Billy Meyer just looking at us. Something told him that we were there,
yeah.
And that, you know, it's that same situation where he can sense or feel, you know why people come, because he's had 17 attempts on his life. I'm sure you've spoken to Michael Horn.
Yes.
Someone who has 17 attempts on his life must be a little bit dangerous to someone. And the problem is that Billy is very wary. I was asked not to assail him, but I did go up and say hello, how are you, to him, and just walk by him as if it was perfectly normal. You know, in the attempt that, you know, in the hopes that someday I would be invited back to be able to really open up the story, he did take over 100 pictures of these craft, but he was invited to do that. He did take about 16 millimeter film of these crafts, and one of them the Japanese company Nippon bought, and you can see the craft over a highway where there are cars going under, so there is no model there. They even have the witness that had the car going underneath. They've even talked to that person, and you can see very clearly the craft over the highway, the cars going underneath. So, you know, this is a very real story that has been shut down. Now, you have to ask, why was it shut down? The reason it was shut down, I believe, this is Paula Harris' opinion, is because these people resembled us. They came from a system that we're very aware of. Even the Native Americans are aware of the Pleiades. They have their own, you know, stories about their ancestors
sure.
from the Pleiades. And they had very political messages, George. They had political messages about our future. Now, for people who want to read about this, Guido Mosbrucker's book that came out just now, the And Still Lay Fly, which is an updated version, has prophecies of the future in there, and it even includes comments about the European community, the economic community, the joining
sure.
of all the economic community here in Europe, and where that's going to bring, and whether Switzerland's going to remain neutral or not. When you have these prophecies and when you have these definite messages from these people, then somebody like Billy Mayer becomes a little bit dangerous.
There's no question about that. What can you give us some of the prophecies that that they have passed on?
Well, you know, I was reading the last part of And Still Lay Fly because I knew I was doing this transmission, and it talks about Switzerland's possibility not remaining neutral because they're going to get sucked into alliances where we're going into an aggressive state in the third millennium here. We're going to be making alliances and going into wars. And that this could be averted if people would wake up. And it was talking about economic wars. This economic union is going to make people more enslaved than free, and they would have to go along with what was decided in Brussels and so forth. These are things that they are predicting. Now, I'm not saying that they're necessarily going to come true, but these were ideas that were given to Billy Mayer, and we're talking 1970s. When I look at the dates of these contacts, when I look at the Pleiadians coming in the 70s, when I look at the Charles Hall story being 65 to 67, which is before the moon landing, which is before Close Encounters, I'm seeing evidence way back when that we were being given definite cosmic messages.
Michael, let's turn to you for just one second here, and I just want to get your take on the evidence. I'm getting fast blasts from people who say, great show, I love the subject, but where's the hard evidence? The hard evidence so that we can see it. Now, you know, you may say that there are captured ships at Area 51 and they have this and that, but where's the hard evidence that we can see?
Well, the question is, what happens to the hard evidence? I mean, whenever there is hard evidence supplied, what happens to it if it's something that does pass laboratory tests? Now, I do recall that in the case of Billy Mayer, for example, that Lee Elders, who did some of the early investigation of the case, did take some of the material that Billy supplied that was supposedly from a Pleiadian ship, took it in for laboratory analysis. And the laboratory tests were very positive initially, and then for some reason the material disappeared. Now, this is something that has happened in other cases involving materials that have been that have been gained by contactees, those with extraterrestrial experiences, that the physical evidence that they have is taken away if it's something that is demonstrably out of this world. Then you have the photographs. Well, the photographs that, in the case of the Billy Mayer contacts, are quite extensive. And there are other contactees who have taken many photos, and these are things that we can look at in terms of, well, how credible are they? And many of them have been shown to not be obvious forgeries. Now, that doesn't prove that they're real, but it just shows that they're not forgeries. So you've got to look at the photos. You need to look at the testimony of the experience of the contactee. You need to look at corroborating evidence. Were there witnesses who saw the contactee go up into a ship or accompanied them? Are there documents that show that the contactee or the experiencer did work at a certain place, such as Charles Hall, who was able to prove that he did work, or he was stationed at Nellis Air Force Base, and other weather observers were able to verify that. So when you look at all of those things, you get supporting evidence. But, I mean, we need to understand that this is a phenomenon that has been covered up for more than 50 years now, and that the success for the cover-up is to be able to manipulate the evidence that is available and to be able to confiscate that. And we know that this is a very serious procedure, that those that are responsible for ensuring that this doesn't break in the public arena do use deadly force to ensure that evidence doesn't fall into the wrong hands.
Did they ever talk about a propulsion system or how they got here? Any of the witnesses ever say that?
Yes, many speak about anti-gravity drives. Now, the interesting thing about the Charles Hall case is that he speaks about the tall whites having both anti-gravity drives and also nuclear-powered propulsion systems. And he said, which was very interesting, that in the agreements that the tall whites reached with the U.S. Air Force, that the tall whites would assist the Air Force in developing the scout craft that would be powered by nuclear propulsion, but they wouldn't give the anti-gravity propulsion system to the U.S. government because they thought that this was technology that was too powerful and would give the U.S. Air Force too many capabilities. So there are different propulsion systems, and looking at the testimony of someone like Captain Bill Uhouse, he actually worked on a propulsion system, an anti-gravity drive, in the 50s and 60s, where he worked with extraterrestrials who helped with that. So it seems that there are probably more than one group of extraterrestrials that the government has agreements with, and that these, in various degrees, are assisting the U.S. military in developing various propulsion systems.
Paula, how about wormholes? Anybody ever talk about that? Did that ever come up in any of your discussions?
No, not the wormhole discussion, but just adding on to what Dr. Sala said, the reason why they didn't want to work on the other kind of propulsion system, the tall whites, was because they didn't want us going into deep space. In other words, I don't think we're welcome in deep space. In other words, we can use craft around the Earth and so forth, but I think that the ET technology, I think they know exactly what they're giving, and I think they're giving it in bits and pieces because they're not quite sure we as human beings can handle what they're giving us and what we're going to use it for. Let's remember, George, it could also be used against them. So and I think it's really, really interesting that what we're interested in the most, and this Colonel Corso told me, he said, you know, the big mistake we made is we're looking at the propulsion system, we're looking at the metals, we're looking at the fiber optics, and Charles Hall talks about miles of fiber optics that he saw in the double hull of the scout craft. We're looking at this, but Colonel Corso said, we didn't look at the alien bodies very carefully. We never considered what was inside. And I have to talk about that because I'm mostly interested in what was inside.
Me too. I think that would have been critical. Why didn't we?
Because I think this is the whole secret or the whole crux of the matter about the UFO question is that who gets the technology, who utilizes the technology, because it's a technology game, gets to be the winner or the master of the universe. So we don't have, and we keep using the word government, but I don't know if it's government or if it's more military thinking than government thinking. I think that when we look at the idea of the military and, you know, all militaries, that their idea is for public, national security, but also how to protect the planet, how to use a technology. And unfortunately, it's not how to use a technology to help us replace oil. It's how to use a technology so we will be stronger than the next power. This is a human way of thinking. They're not thinking about the spiritual angle, which we haven't even touched. When they're not speaking about how we're created, where we come from, are we inseminated from the stars? They're not looking at any of that. They're looking at only what they can get from this kind of contact that's actual nuts and bolts type technology. In fact, one of the things about the Charles Hall story is that the tall whites said that some of the pieces on their scout craft were made here on Earth. which blows me away. And he said that they said they weren't very good pieces. In other words, they were faulty.
Must have been made in China.
Yeah, they were faulty materials, and they said when they put the scout craft together, because they said they had to do some repairs here on Earth, that they weren't very confident that they could go very far with the materials that we were giving them.
Has anybody ever asked them, Michael or Paula, has anybody ever asked these extraterrestrials if they believe in God?
Well, I know that. In the Billy Meyer case, that the extraterrestrials talked about a universal law, a system of morality that was applicable throughout the known universe, and that this was something that extraterrestrials followed. So they didn't speak necessarily of a person,
a creator, for example. Did they say anything about that? How things could come back to one? Or I guess not, huh?
Well, I think they just talked about the deviation that we as a race have undergone because we didn't follow these universal laws or the law of one, as sometimes it's called, and that there was a need to get back to that if we were to be able to progress as a civilization and evolve to full membership of, say, the galactic community.
The silence, though, of both of you, Paula, kind of tells me that...
I'm waiting for Michael to finish, but there is a place in Charles's book where the teacher, and Charles names these
people. And what's the name of his book again, by the way?
It's called Millennial Hospitality. It's in 3 volumes. You can get it on Amazon, or you can contact the halls, and they have copies, too. But in Millennial Hospitality, there is a place where the teacher talks to the other... Watala Whiteson says he believes in God, and Charles, and so for her to say he believes in God, she has an idea of what God is all about. And from the witness testimony that I've done my research on, there is a common belief in a universal creative source, not necessarily a person, but a universal creative force that created the whole entire universe, including all the life in it.
Okay.
Including all the people in it, all the life forms in it. So I think that has come through with the contactees. I think, I was talking to John Mack about this, and that is a common thread. It has to be. I mean, that is the first thing you'd ask when you talk to people, from other planets, is what their faith is and how we came to be created and how this all came about. So, yeah, there is a common thread that there is a creative force. And I think that, but if you want to get into what's been done with the idea of religion, then we're looking at the possibility that the religions on this planet have separated us more than united us, and that gets into very tricky situations.
Well, there's no question about that. As a matter of fact, nearly every war on this planet is fought either because of economics or of religion. There's no other reason. I'm George Norrie. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. With Paula Harris, Dr. Michael Sulla. Of course, one of the best stories, I think, also the story of Colonel Philip Corso. A friend of mine, Bill Burns, wrote the book with him the day after Roswell. This is an incredible story, as you know, Paula, of a colonel in the military who decided to, before he passed on, to tell it the way he saw it. And I don't think we've had a case like that in a long, long time, if ever.
No, and the thing is, an investigator, and I ask myself why this happens to me, is because I was very close to Colonel Corso. I was the journalist that brought him to Italy twice. And I was able to spend long periods of time, including a whole week at Easter with him, just speaking about these things on a personal level, because he had his family with him. So I have the background of Alan Hynek, with whom I worked. I have the background of Colonel Corso, of Michael Wolff, of a series of people that I consider extremely credible. So when I meet, so I'm very wary when I'm doing a story. So when I meet this case of Charles Hall, I have to put together everything that I've been told. I have to put together everything that I think was the truth. I have to put together a puzzle. And Corso had a tremendous amount of courage to come out with what he came out with. But let's remember, Colonel Corso also claims to have had a contact. And that's in my book, Connecting the Dots, Making Sense of the UFO Phenomenon. In fact, That contact is not in the day after Roswell, but that contact is the first thing he told me when I interviewed him in Roswell in 1997. And when he gave me that interview, I did not print it because I had this nuts and bolts attitude where if I print this, they're going to think you're crazy. So I didn't do it until after he died. But the contact that Colonel Corso talks about having in Red Canyon with the being talks about a new world if we can take it. Those were the being's words, and people, if they want. In fact, I was even thinking of playing the audio for you on the show because I kept the audio of that interview.
Do you have some of it with you?
I have it here, yeah.
How long is it?
I have that audio of that interview where he's asking me what that means, and he's telling me how he met this being in Red Canyon 1957.
All right. How long does it run, Paula?
Well, it's about 6 or 7 minutes.
All right.
The first interview.
Let's play it this hour.
Well, I can't get it. It's in my filing cabinet. I have all the audio of all my interviews put away. But I would be glad to do it for you another time. You can hear his voice.
Okay, well, I thought you had it there.
He is a real, important witness, and he is very credible, and he talks about contact. So here he is talking about having met this being, and I'm thinking, Colonel, you're laying on me something that I can't digest right now because I just want to deal with back engineering, and you're throwing contact at me. And, I've learned so much since Colonel Corso because contact is not such an unusual thing. And this being was telling us about the future, was saying to Colonel Corso, and Colonel Corso said to him, what is it that you have to offer me? Because the being asked him if he wanted to come aboard the craft, which was appearing and disappearing in Red Canyon. It was in the desert when Colonel Corso was in charge of the nuclear missile battalion that he had not contact with this being. He said to the being, I know what you people are capable of doing. I don't exactly trust you. He had his gun out. The being, Colonel Corso said to the being, what is it that you have to offer me? And the being answered, a new world if you can handle it.
Interesting indeed. Michael Sala, did you ever meet Corso?
No, I never met him. He certainly was an important figure. And what Paula just described, I think, is very significant, that there were these meetings that occurred and that people like Philip Corso were aware of the significance of this. And he did talk about it in the day after Roswell, what the implications were. And he didn't speak of it in very favorable terms. I mean, that I guess needs to be kind of pointed out, that he wasn't that enthusiastic about the kind of interactions that were occurring. Now, whether that was truly what he felt or whether that was something that was added in by his co-author, William Burns, I'm not sure of. But certainly, Philip Corso did have access to very significant documents and meetings and technologies concerning extraterrestrials, and I think that's one of the cases that does point to just how serious this is and what the political implications are, because, I mean, we have a whole infrastructure surrounding that you just don't have isolated meetings and retrievals of extraterrestrial technologies, that all this happens within a very thought-out political process, and that means that there's a lot of work that's been put into setting up an infrastructure. And again, Philip Corso gives us a bit of the puzzle.
What's the procedure, Michael, for an extraterrestrial, if you'd kind of take us through it, where who makes the contact? Do they make it with us? Do we make it with them? And what do they do? How do they communicate?
Well, we're talking about different extraterrestrial races here. I mean, there seems to be very different protocols that are followed by extraterrestrials. Some extraterrestrials, for example, have a very elaborate protocol where they, for example, will first of all make initial contact with an individual by putting suggestions into their mind, some kind of telepathic contact. Then there's a meeting, a physical meeting with typically a human-looking extraterrestrial where the person is made to feel comfortable with that extraterrestrial. Then there's a sighting of a ship. And then there's a possible trip where the human or the contactee goes inside of the ship. Those are that's a particular protocol followed by certain extraterrestrial races. Other races seem to follow a very different protocol, the abduction phenomenon, where people are taken up often involuntarily, having their memories altered so that they don't recall the events, and it's only through some regressive hypnosis that they're able to recall what happened, and that these events aren't always pleasurable. I mean, sometimes people suffer some severe trauma as a result of that. So those are other contactee cases. And then, of course, there are the meetings with government officials, and we know that Eisenhower went through that, and that what happened in the Eisenhower meeting was that many of the servicemen who were present apparently took physically ill because of the extraterrestrials. It was such a world-shattering experience for them to see the extraterrestrials. So it shows that if there isn't the preparation done, that meeting extraterrestrials is something that can produce very traumatic effects in humans. And Charles Hall did talk about how it took him 6 months before he would actually believe what he was seeing with his eyes was real. So we are talking about a phenomenon that is very difficult to accept, and it does take time for people to condition, and extraterrestrials have different protocols in how they go about this.
At what point in your life or career, Michael, did you get convinced that we were being visited?
It happened for me in 2001 when I heard the Disclosure Project that Stephen Greer organized at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C.
So prior to that, you weren't a believer in this, huh?
No, not at all. I didn't follow this at all. I had no interest in that phenomenon. I was pretty straightforward in terms of being a political scientist focusing on international conflict and looking at how to deal with that phenomenon. But when I saw that particular press conference and heard the testimonies, I realized that this was real because, I mean, what you had was, I think it was 22 whistleblowers talking about their experiences. And when I realized the significance of this, I knew that this would help me understand the nature of international politics much better than I could with the conventional resources I was using at the time.
Paula, how about you? How about when was your first episode, your case? What got you interested in this?
Well, in 1978, when I saw Close Encounters of the Third Kind, I had an emotional reaction to the contact scene at the end, and I didn't know why. And I began to research the fact that there was an association called CUFOS, the Center for UFO Studies in Evanston, Illinois. And in my book, I talk about all the accidents or all the coincidences that happened in my life that lead me to today, to 2004. I wanted to meet Alan Hynek. I wanted to meet the man that was doing the actual objective research. He was an astronomer. He was a scientist. He had worked on Project Blue Book. He was also the consultant to the film. So when I met Alan Hynek, and then when we became close friends, on my website, by the way, I have some original pictures of Alan Hynek and me way back when, a very young Paula Harris, when we were working together from 1980 to 1986, just before he died. And I began to realize with his method of questioning, and I think I was taught by the best, with his objectivity, that this was real, that this was something to be researched, that we needed to have some very professional people doing this kind of research, that it was very important. And as Alan used to say, it can't be done by volunteers on the weekends when they have some extra time. So, you know, I started way back when, and then with my education background, and Michael and I both, you know, with our education background, we also look at the philosophy of this. It's not just the contact or the nuts and bolts reality, but also the implications of this. I realized that I needed to make this kind of an important life mission.
Tell me a little bit about Clifford Stone.
Well, Clifford Stone is so underrated. You know, it's unbelievable. He was part of the Disclosure Project with Stephen Greer, and I talked to Clifford. He's a personal friend. Clifford Stone was a contactee, first of all, had telepathic ability. So when he was 16 years old, he was asked to join the military, even though he was supposed to be exempt because of his physical incapabilities. He had problems with his spine. He thought he was in a nuclear biological unit, but instead what he was is in a crash retrieval situation. And he was being used because he had telepathic ability. I mean, those people that have telepathic ability are those people that can communicate with these beings. So he found himself, and he talks about his first contact with a situation like this, and he even names the city, Indian Town Cap, Pennsylvania. He names the date 1969, when he finds himself in a situation of crash retrieval, of which the beings were the Grays, and they, he said in that case all four occupants were dead. But then when I'm talking to Clifford in his house in Roswell, he's telling me all the other details of all the other races that are here, not all Grays, and he's saying that some of them have families. He's saying that some of them are integrated, which means that we have a few walking around. And he says that he participated in at least 8 crash retrievals, and as Dr. Sala just mentioned, some of them were in Europe.
I don't believe I had either one of you on after John Mack had passed away, getting hit by a car in London, England. Michael, would you like to say a few words about John Mack and then you, Paula?
Well, he was very important, clearly because of the stature that he had as a tenured Harvard professor and Pulitzer Prize winner. So he had a lot of credibility, and he staked his reputation on the line by coming out in support of the testimonies that he gathered through his treatment of various patients who discussed the abductions that they had. And he was able to develop a very well thought through procedure for analyzing the abductions, and to be able to present that to the general public in a way that was very scholarly and very persuasive and helped open people up to the reality of this phenomenon. So his loss is definitely going to be severely felt.
How about you, Paula?
Thanks for asking that, George, because he was a personal friend and I've really suffered over that loss. I mean, he was here at my house in November of last year for that conference in Florence where, you know, Linda Howe was this year. And John Mack, I also spent some time with him on vacation in August in Newport, Rhode Island, thanks to Anne Cuvelier. And the thing is that he was on vacation with Bud Hopkins. Now, when I was with them both, we've got two different points of view here on the contact scenario or the abduction scenario, and I saw those two people being good friends, and I'm hoping that that would be a model for people to research together, even with opposing ideas on contact. But I miss him so much because he is a credible. He was compassionate. He was like Alan. Alan Hynek, who was compassionate. He was respectful of the people that he interviewed, of the people that he was with, and he was ever so credible because he was a Harvard University psychiatrist, someone who had a background who said to his colleagues, I know I'm swimming upstream.
Yep.
I know I'm doing something that is not popular, but this is real, and we need to look at it. And his speech here in Florence said, we need to look at a new paradigm or look at a new world view of how we're looking at this phenomenon. A new world, if you can take it, the same thing as Colonel Corso said. We need to look at a new paradigm. And listen, I thank you for being part of this, because if it wasn't for your show, we wouldn't even have the opportunity of looking at it.
Well, remember the line from Contact where Jody said, well, how did you get this device? And he said, well, we didn't build it. It was given to us. I guess I could say the same thing about the show. I didn't build it. It was just given to me. Simple as that. You know, when I was a little boy, Paula, I used to go outside, look at the stars, and try to use my mind to create a UFO. I thought I could get one to come down and beam me up or something, and it never worked. But I wonder how many people have that kind of ability. What do you think?
Well, I know that Stephen Greer gets together in the Rocky Mountains. I haven't been able to do it yet because I never have time, with a group of people with CSETI. And I know those people because they're you know, in Canyon City and those different places in the Rockies. And he actually trains them to go out. But you have to go out between 2 in the morning and 5 in the morning, and that's not exactly my ideal time. And he uses kind of a laser, and he actually can vector some of them in, and they come pretty close. Stephen is only one example of Skywatch. Here in Italy, we have the same thing, and I've seen film footage of them coming in close. Of course, it's at night. Of course, it's their lights, and they come very close. But I really, truly believe that contact can be made telepathically. That's how they do it. If you really want it, you have to go out at 2 in the morning, George.
How many countries, Michael, do you believe contact has been made with governments?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer because we know that the U.S. government has made contact and has successfully covered that up, but whistleblowers do come forward to talk about that. I know that we have had some people come forward discussing the involvement of, say, the British government in covering up evidence of crash retrievals in Britain. So there's evidence there that the British are very heavily involved in this international cover-up or cooperation in dealing with extraterrestrial technologies, with the US taking the lead. We also know that there were crash retrievals done in South Africa and also in various countries in South America. So I believe that there are a number of countries that are aware of this phenomenon. I guess it would be done in very similar ways to how it happens here in the US, where it's typically the military who take control of this. It's very very much compartmentalized. Not everyone, even in the military, is aware of this, and certainly not everyone in the government is aware, but you would have an international system in place where those governments that come into access of ET technologies, ships or ET beings themselves, would pass that information on to the U.S.
Well, when we come right back, we're going to also find out what you can do to receive more information on the UFO phenomena. We'll also open up the phone lines. We'll give you an opportunity to talk with Paula Harris or Dr. Michael Sulla. And tell you what, when you do call, why don't you direct your call to one of them? That'll be a little easier for us as we move along right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. If you need to email me, well, that's very simple, too. That's george@coasttocoastam.com. A few more questions for you, Paula, and you, Michael Sulla, before we go to the phone calls. First of all, Michael, if we're being visited, why aren't they showing themselves directly to us? And I don't mean in the, you know, hey, there's a UFO or I saw a being out in the woods. Why aren't they coming down talking to us?
Well, we need to look at some of the major sightings that have occurred where you've had thousands of people seeing extraterrestrial ships. We've had sightings, mass sightings in Washington, D.C. in 1952. You had mass sightings in Phoenix in 1997. You also had mass sightings in Belgium, in Mexico City. So there are many mass sightings where individuals see the ships and they are discussed, and the thing is that the mass media doesn't pick them up, or it's not a worldwide phenomenon, that the rest of the global media basically ignores it. So you have evidence of this cover-up that we've been talking about, where there is a system in place to ensure that whatever evidence exists doesn't get out to the general public. And I think also the big question is, what would the extraterrestrials gain by just simply showing up on the White House lawns if the government already has agreements with other extraterrestrial races? You know, would that basically be an act of war? I mean, if you can imagine, if a country has an agreement with a different country, and then a third country suddenly introduces some of its ships on the territory of one of those countries, would that be like an act of war? So here we have a situation where there are agreements in place, and so it means that certain extraterrestrial ships.
Hold on, who? Paula, is that you?
Well, you know, as far as us, I know what you're saying, George, because I want to see something too. I've never seen a UFO. When you say yes, I think you mean all of us. But here in Italy, and I'll speak for Italy, in the 1970s, we had a mass sighting over a soccer stadium. And they were playing soccer. They interrupted the whole entire soccer game of this extraterrestrial ship. I don't think it was our stuff. And it was hovering over the soccer stadium in Florence. Now, that's mass sighting as far as I'm concerned. And then it let loose this kind of sand-like white material that we call angel hair so that someone was able to analyze it, and it's very, very close to glass in its analysis. So there is a mass sighting right there. The soccer players are stopping to look up in the sky. All the people are stopping to look at it. It was covered in the newspapers. So we have it, but we can't explain it. And I think that when we're looking at how many of these mass sightings, and we've had them all over the world, and they were even an example of them were even in Close Encounters, what we should be asking is, why isn't anybody taking this seriously enough to put together a serious approach to the UFO question and stop making it ridiculous, laughable, and so on? I think that's the question, because the mass sightings, whether they've been in Florence or other places in South America all the time, have happened.
Okay, and Michael, as far as, and by the way, both of you are sharing a phone bank, so if one drops the phone, we all hear it, so be careful, okay? The ability for these extraterrestrials to travel in space, there are some who think that maybe they may be coming from a hollow Earth, maybe they may be time travelers. Are you still convinced they're extraterrestrials from other planets?
Well, I think there is evidence of all of those things. I mean, people have been coming forward, giving testimony about their experiences with races that may be from the hollow Earth, even from the future, and of course, the extraterrestrial. So we have numbers of people coming forward talking about this. As far as what the whistleblowers discuss, they typically focus on the extraterrestrial phenomenon. So as far as government employees or military servicemen who come forward, the focus there is off-world beings. So when we talk about inner world beings or the time travelers, that typically is more people who have had contacts or experiences, but not the whistleblowers, who do focus primarily on that off-world extraterrestrial presence.
All right, let's go to the phones. Wildcard Line, you are on the air. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Phoenix, Arizona.
Welcome, and who's your question for?
My question is for Paula.
All right, take it away.
I read a story once called Danger Human, and it was a science fiction story, and the premise of the story was that all of the extraterrestrials in the universe gave humans wide berth and didn't provoke them. And at the point of time in the story, we had broken the bonds of our planet and, you know, kind of rampaged around the universe and then settled on another planet. But we'd done that three times. And that was basically the policy, is danger human. I'm wondering, perhaps the extraterrestrials, are they not sharing as much technology as they can because they consider us dangerous?
Paula, this is for you.
Okay, you know, I really believe that, I mean, anybody who thinks about this logically knows that we can use it against them. I mean, anybody that's looking at this politically the way Michael is, the way anybody that's analyzing this politically knows that whatever technology is advanced, we could be into some kind of conflict in the future. And as Wernher von Braun and Carol Rosen have mentioned, that there's a possibility that when we've run out of enemies, we're going to invent another one, and that would be so sad for us to go up against them with their own technology. They're not stupid. I think they know that we're capable of this because we're not a very evolved planetary group of people. We're still warring. We're still at war. We're still not in a mode where we're too peaceful. So, yeah, I think they give us only the amount that we can handle, and I think they would never I don't know for a fact, so I can't speak for a fact, but just logically, I think that we would be, if we had the technology that they have and started using it against them, I think that they would consider us a threat.
Well, you know, Stanton Friedman always says that we're just not ready for the galactic group, and he's right. He really is. Next up, let's go west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, and good morning to you folks. Could I ask one question of each guest? Would that be all right?
Sure thing, sir. Go ahead.
Okay, Mike, on Crop Circle Connector, I believe it's 2002 or 2003 series, there was a graphic of a gray holding a disc. I'm not sure if you've been able to see those crop circles in England, but if you multiply the horizontal lines behind the gray by pi and you multiply the rings in the disk by pi, you get the latitude and longitude to the minute of the Roswell site. And I'm just wondering if you'd heard about that. And the question for Paula is, I'm just wondering if maybe she'd heard of Ludi Francesca or spoke to Colonel Stevens about some of the activities that went on in conjunction with Billy Myers. There were 8 or 9 other contactees at that time. I'm just wondering if either one of you have any information on those issues there.
Okay, well, let's start with you, Michael, on his crop circle question.
Well, I don't know about the particular one that he referred to, but I am aware of another involving a picture of an extraterrestrial with a circle that had a message encoded in there.
That's the same picture, yeah.
Okay, oh, good. All right. Well, that one, the message, as I recall it being decoded, was beware of strangers bearing false gifts, something to the effect that... we needed to be wary of certain extraterrestrial groups. So it was a warning from one extraterrestrial group directed against other extraterrestrial groups. So basically what that crop circle signifies is that the ETs themselves are very wary of one another and are passing on that message.
Yeah, did that also include the issue that one group of greys were friendly because they were hybrids, and the old ones that were the long lost mercenary types were the bad apples? Was that the same study? Do you recall?
I'm not sure of those two different categories of greys. I'm just familiar with the picture itself.
Okay, and what was your Billy Meyer question again, sir?
Yeah, I was just wondering if Paula had interviewed. I believe Colonel Wendell Stevens had a lot to do with the initiation of Billy's first publication, the book Contact from the Pleiades. And I'm just wondering if she was aware that there were... I spoke to Colonel Stevens, if she was aware that there were 7 or 8 other individuals like Billy that were contacted roughly around the same time period at different countries around the world. Paula, I was just wondering...
Last summer, I went to see... actually, the summer before, it was the summer of 2002 that I went to see Wendell Stevens before I went to Billy Meyer, because I wanted to go with Wendell. Wendell is a good friend, and I wanted to go together with him. In fact, he'll be coming back to Europe, I think, to go back there. I wanted to ask him if there was anything that he could do to reopen that case, and also the fact that Wendell Stevens worked with Jim Dellatoso, who worked for NASA at the time. So here we have a NASA kind of laboratory that's analyzing these pictures and finding them credible. To me, that interested me a lot. Yes, I did talk to Wendell Stevens. I really believe that his research is very valid. He did a great job. I would love it if he could actually reopen this case. I flew down to Arizona with David Coote, you know, the pilot that I had mentioned before, to talk to Wendell before I even went to Switzerland. He did a lot of good work. I think people should look at his books, Messages from the Pleiades. He wrote 3 of them, and they really give accurate messages.
Next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air. Hi there. I think you're on the air. Hello? You're not on the air anymore. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, hello?
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, the question is direct, I think, more toward Paula, but I guess I enjoy both of the Dr. Salen here. I have a question, and then I want to make a statement. If I'm to understand, and I want to make sure that I do, that neither you, Paula, nor Dr. Salen have seen these tall whites yourself. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. Have you considered that the tall, 8-foot woman that Harold saw and the small child fit the description of alien second or third generation, or maybe more, hybrids from embryos or fetuses from abducted European Earth women? So they describe these in the Matrix books, Richard's Dr. Saunders books, the Shaver mysteries, and that the reason that Harold was allowed to speak about them might be because they fit the alien itinerary to introduce at this time a mind-controlled hybrid, which may be more acceptable, and you may be describing Earthlings' replacement if these wars, plagues, pole shifts, hurricanes, earthquakes, and all considered, continue.
Hmm. Who wants it? You, Paula? Michael?
Don't well, that's a big question. That includes all of them. That's got so much in it. Yeah, that's a possibility, except if you read Millennial Hospitality, Charles is very clear that these people, come from another star, from another star system, from another planet, and they are not from this Earth or hybrids from this Earth, but they are quite separate from the Earth hybridization, which could have happened, but he actually makes it clear they are not.
How can he be sure of that, since there are so many other kind of contactees, from Chupacabras to Olmecs? I mean, there's so many others. Why is he so sure of this? In fact, if they wanted to do this, and they're allowing him through you, and of course through George Norrie, who still goes everywhere, to make this as a placating factor, why couldn't this be the case?
Well, because they're not. This is not necessarily. He wasn't abductive. He saw these people every day for 2.5 years. This is not an abduction or contact situation. They would come up from the valley where they were living. He saw the craft coming back and forth. It was an everyday occurrence. They were part of the people that were on the base with him.
No.
So I imagine that if he's telling the truth, and I only have to go with his testimony, that's what that implicates, that it was contact from people that are hosted here on Earth.
No, I believe what he is saying. What I'm saying is not that he was abducted, not at all, that he is talking to fetuses or embryos that are already been abducted, that may be now be released so he can see them, so he can accept them with the story that they tell or the supporters of it are telling.
Well, I think another aspect to look at is the technology agreements that were in place. What that indicated was that the U.S. Air Force was very interested in the technology that these tall whites were able to exchange with them. So that would indicate some kind of off-world visitor who had technology that wasn't native to Earth, whereas the explanation you give would suggest some long-term cloning process that would be orchestrated by beings that are located on the Earth.
Paula, the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind was based on Dr. J. Allen Hynek's book of the same title. Great book, by the way. I remember when it came out, I just ripped it apart just to look at it and read it as quickly as I could. How realistic was that story, was that book, was that movie?
I think it was very realistic, and I think it was very symbolic. A lot of things that I found out about that film later on, I found out how that was suggested to Spielberg, that Uri Geller was at the same party with Jacques Vallée and Jack Sarfati and Francis Ford Coppola when this all came about, the idea for this. I found out that Devil's Tower was used because the Native Americans believed that that particular mountain was a bear that had clawed its way up going after the Seven Sisters, which are the Pleiades. It has a symbolic meaning, Devil's Tower, Wyoming. So it's in the Native American tradition. And then later on, the idea of a programmed landing was very real. A programmed landing where people were told that there was some kind of biological threat, so they were told to go away and not go to this place. But look who was invited. All the people that had been contacted, all the contactees, were invited by the ETs to be part of this, which to me, George, means that there are people that are invited, and it's maybe not the government, the president, the Senate, and so forth, that are invited. In other words, it could be that the ETs are going to the people or the extraterrestrials are going directly to the people, and they're not necessarily going to go through diplomatic means like they have for the last, I don't know, a couple of years. Maybe that what's happening is they're going directly to the people.
Would you be surprised, Paula, if you got a call one day from someone in government and they said, we'd like you to come to our building in Washington, D.C., and in you went, and they had pictures for you and information about extraterrestrials that have landed here since the beginning of time. Would that surprise you?
Not at all.
Would you love to go?
I would go, but I think I'd ask the obvious question, and that's the one I'm interested in as an educator. Well, where do we go from here? Like, what does this mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, what are we going to do with this?
Yeah, I agree with that. How about you, Michael? Would you be surprised?
Well, I'd certainly look at what that would achieve. What would be the purpose of going in and being given a tour of government facilities where they have this kind of evidence? Could I use that, or would that in some way kind of restrict me from doing what I'm doing now?
Well, and what would you do if they asked you not to tell anyone? Would you come back on the show and tell us what you saw?
Well, if you're asking me, that's a good question. You know, I got to honestly tell you that a lot of the interviews that I did in my book, connecting the dots, making sense of the UFO phenomenon. There's a lot of stuff I didn't print, George, because it's not ethical to print everything. I just don't think it's necessary that everything be out. I don't think we're ready for that. I think there's a slow process release of information. I think that we've got to go at this slowly, and I do believe in national security. I do believe in world security. I do believe in that. So the thing is that you have to be very careful and very ethical about what you print.
We'll be back with the rest of the phone calls. Boy, what a fast night. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM with our guest, Paula Harris, Dr. Michael Sala. Their website's linked up with coasttocoastam.com. Just by their names, already set up for you. There's a link. There's even a picture there of Paula Harris with the late Dr. J. Allen Hynek. It's a collector's item. Back in a moment. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Paula Harris, Dr. Michael Sala, our guests, and you, of course, your phone calls. Let's get right to them because this last hour will click by very quickly. First-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello there.
Yes, sir.
My question, my statement is a question from Michael.
Okay.
All right. Michael, 30 years ago last month, I had a close encounter with a space vehicle. I call it a space vehicle. And right after it happened, I went home and made a cassette recording and a drawing of what I had seen. And then I reported it to the local UFO society that's, I'm in Tomball, Texas. There's one in Houston. And a fellow came out and interviewed me and took a statement and a copy of my drawing. And then reported to me that about 2 weeks later, a similar vehicle was seen in South Africa and did a similar thing, which is shoot these fireballs out the back that set the ground on fire and scared the heck out of a family. About 2 months later, through this UFO society, I was visited by two men who reportedly were from the Air Force. There was a colonel and a major, and they wanted to talk to me. And they made a copy of my cassette recording, and I took copies of my drawings. And they came back twice, and then a third time they asked me to take what most people call a lie detector test, which was 60 questions over a period of 1 hour. And as they reported to me, all my answers were truthful. And they told me that they would have a report back to me within about 60 days. Well, when I called the numbers on their card, it was a non-working number. And when I wrote the Air Force to ask them where these men were now working, I was told they didn't exist. So what the heck happened to me, and who were these guys?
Well, I think you were visited by some group that whose responsibility it is to monitor those that have had some kind of contact experience. And that would be a group that is very highly classified, and so wouldn't necessarily be something that the Air Force or other authorities would be necessarily aware of. And so I think that is something that many people have experienced in various ways, and I guess in your case you were fortunate in that you didn't lose the material that you had put together, nor were you in any way threatened or hurt by this. But others have experienced some negative consequences from those sorts of visitations.
Well, what was unique about my experience is the UFO Society in Houston got a copy of the drawing from this family in South Africa. They also reported it. And our drawings are almost identical. There were some slight dimensional things, like I said it was X long and they said it was X long. There's some slight differences there, but the vehicles looked identical, and it was really strange. I mean, I still, even now, 30 years later, I feel really weird, especially since these guys grilled me, and then nothing ever happened.
Well, I think, like many others who have had some kind of contact experience, it's really a question of familiarizing yourself with exactly what the ETs wanted to achieve by allowing you to see them, to witness them, and also to develop any skills that might be necessary for you to be able to make some meaning out of that. And I think there are resources available. You'll find on some of my sites the idea of private citizens doing some kind of communication, I call it track two galactic diplomacy, where people develop skills so that they can make more sense out of these types of interactions. So you can find that information on the websites that are on the Coast to Coast website.
Very good. By the way, we posted another one of your websites, Michael, under your name, galacticdiplomacy.com. What is that one?
Well, that looks at this concept of Track 2 galactic diplomacy, which is basically a combination of what I've done in the past in terms of Track 2 diplomacy, which involved private citizens who got involved in trying to develop diplomatic initiatives to resolve international conflict. And so I've developed that a little further to bring in the galactic component, which is the fact that we are visited by very different extraterrestrial races who are interacting with private civilians, who have agreements with the government. And so those who have this kind of experience or want to develop skills so that they can follow up on any possible communication with extraterrestrials can develop a better understanding of what Track 2 Galactic Diplomacy is all about.
Paula, what can people do if they want a little bit more information on the UFO phenomena?
Well, the first thing they can do, in my book, Connecting the Dots, I have a whole list of books that people can read, and they come from the interviews that I did. Plus, there's my website that I had that's also on your website, but I really want to reiterate what Dr. Sala is doing right now is the next step. I really believe that if the ET situation, if it goes to the people, if the people are being contacted, then the people need to look at what they need to do or what the protocol is or what the different way of dealing with this phenomena is, because maybe you can't just go to agencies or maybe you can't just go to groups or whatever. Maybe you need to find a way of dealing with this phenomenon yourself. So, yeah, they can read, they can research. Mostly they need to stop ridiculing the subject. They need to take it seriously. When something like the Mexican case happened last year in May, where the Mexican Department of Defense is claiming 11 UFOs were around a plane, we're talking about something serious that should not be laughed at.
Okay, thank you for that. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast, you're on with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. How are you tonight?
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
This is a question for both of your panelists. Actually, I'd like to start off by saying that I think that dropping this in the lap of the public would really be a slippery slope. But I was kind of wondering about the 7-year-old Russian boy that you're reporting on, because it makes a lot of sense to me that if our planet is too warm in the center for us to inhabit, that Mars, if it's too cold on the surface, might actually be inhabitable towards the center of it. And I was wondering what your panelists thought about that idea. I'll listen offline to it.
Okay. And again, I'm making reference to a 7-year-old Russian boy who is acting as if and talks as if he came from Mars, not as the boy, but as apparently a past life. And it's a remarkable story. And he claims, Paula and Michael, that they have gone underground because of the atmospheric problems that they've had. Strange story indeed. But, you know, anything's possible, I guess, huh?
Well, it's all part of what's out there. I mean, if you read what's out there, you're going to have to use a discriminating sense about what's out there. But I think you should put that out there. It's very much possible.
Go ahead, Michael.
And Courtney Brown has actually written about the alleged Martian base or colony on the Earth that is hidden in various locations. You can find that in his second book, Cosmic Explorers, I believe it is, and he talks about that Martian colony. So that was something that a group of remote viewers were able to get information on.
Okay, next up, let's go east of the Rockies. You're up. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, dear.
I wanted to know if either one of you knew anything about the praying mantis aliens.
I think you would probably have some experience there, Paula, the praying mantis-type shaped aliens.
Well, actually, the person that is best at this kind of thing is Dr. Richard Boylan, who deals with contact. He knows all different kinds of races, has it on his website, and people should go on Dr. Boylan's website because he has these races categorized from contactee, from witness testimony. I have never, in my experience, talked to anybody that has seen a praying mantis type, so I've got to be honest with you. But I think there are so many researchers that do good work in this field. So why don't you go on Dr. Boylan's site and see what's said about that.
How about you, Michael? Any experience there?
Well, again, just abductee testimonies that I've read that have referred to praying mantis. And you have the typical range of experiences from very positive to negative. So Again, I guess someone would just need to do the research and find out exactly what is happening with that particular race.
Next up, let's go west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You are on the air. Hi there.
Hi. Good morning, George.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I had a question for Paula.
Yeah.
I was wondering about the craft that was seen years back in Florida. If those same craft were seen in Central California.
Are we talking about the Gulf Breeze incident?
Right, the Gulf Breeze.
Yeah, well, because that's really accurately documented. You asked me before what people can do. Well, read about the Gulf Breeze incident, because those that had massive witness testimony. If I remember correctly, that craft it resembles a lot the craft in Close Encounters, too. Those sightings were very, very important, and I think that since I didn't do the actual research there and I didn't talk to the actual witnesses, it's really hard for me to say anything because I do firsthand witness testimony, but all I can do is really recommend that people read the Gulf Breeze incident books that have come out.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I appreciate your phone call.
Yeah, I had one more thing.
Oh, okay, put the brakes on.
The reason why I brought this up was because when I was really little, I saw these red eyes peering through my window, you know, in the shape of alien eyes, and they were gigantic. And before that, I had an experience where I was levitating, and there was, like, wind gushing around me, that sound, you know, and my body was rotating in a circle. And I was just wondering if those are common experiences.
I don't know. Michael, are they?
Well, many different psychic phenomena are associated with extraterrestrials, and people are sometimes exposed to phenomena where they suddenly develop those abilities themselves. So people really need to do the research. I mean, there's so much information that is available these days, and if you go out and read about it, then maybe you can follow up. But there certainly is a lot of psychic phenomenon, and it seems to be increasing.
Michael, what is Track 2, Galactic Diplomacy?
Well, that's in contrast to Track 1, which is official government diplomacy. So when the government, for example, has negotiations and sets up diplomatic agreements with extraterrestrial races, that's called Track 1. When private citizens begin to work with organizations or with groups such as extraterrestrials, well, that would fall into Track 2, which is basically non-official diplomacy. And that Track 2 diplomacy has been practiced for over 20, 30 years now in international politics. So it's well recognized, and for example, I practiced it myself in East Timor. So it is very well recognized by the international community, and so extending it to extraterrestrials is really just acknowledging that private citizens and groups have a role to play in developing agreements with extraterrestrial races.
All right, let's go to our wild card line. It's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Christine. Yeah, this is really mind-blowing. I wanted to get the title, first of all, of Paula's book. It's Connecting the Dots, Making Sense of the UFO Phenomena. Is that it?
Yes. Yes, it.
Okay. And I forget who mentioned this earlier in the show, but someone said that the Nazis were in contact with the UFOs, and I'm really concerned about the bad ones, you know. Could you tell me you know, something about that, and why are they here, and why are they integrated here, like walking among us?
Well, we have different people on the earth that aren't all the same either. We have different countries, different races. We have different kinds of populaces on the planet anyway. I think that if we are all integrated and we are on planet Earth, it would be normal, too, to have somebody that lives next door or somebody that lives in a star be integrated among us. But I don't really foster the good or bad kind of situation. I just look at the situation the way it is. Maybe Michael would like to look at the Nazi question since it was addressed to him.
Yes, well, that was something I did write about, and it was a chapter in the Exopolitics book, so you find information on that on my website. But essentially, the Nazis were, according to the research I did, the very first government that was able to establish some kind of diplomatic agreement with extraterrestrial races. And so that is something that I think needs to be looked at, and you'll find information in that book that I mentioned, and you can do some more research from that using the references to get more of an idea of exactly what the Nazis did.
Maybe time for one more call or two. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're up with us. Hi there.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Sure thing.
This is Andy. I just thought, I guess my comment is, I'm coming from more of a skeptical end, but I mean, it seems like everybody and her uncle has seen a UFO or been abducted by one except me.
And me.
And you, and I guess my question is, if they, obviously these ETs, or as they're described, want to remain somewhat anonymous and unknown, and yet it seems like everybody's seeing these. And we have agencies in our government that we don't know about. So, I mean, you'd think with their technology, they would be able to keep a little bit more anonymous than this. I mean, it's, I mean, and every photo we see of these things are fuzzy, out of focus. I find it kind of hard to buy, you know what I mean? Why are there so many sightings of these super high technology flying across the universe beings here? I mean, they're popping up more than a TWA.
I'll let you handle that one, Paula.
Okay, well, I don't think they're all fuzzy. First of all, if you look at Filer's Files, and I'm going to recommend some serious research for your listeners, Filer's Files has the latest sightings, and the pictures from Poland, the pictures from England, the pictures from South America are not fuzzy. They're very clear. They're daylight pictures that are coming in. The film footage from the Mexican case last year, and that's Department of Defense, so we're not dealing with contactees. We're not dealing with just regular people. This is the Department of Defense of Mexico City that came across these 11 UFOs in the infrared with a brand new, very, very high stylized infrared camera that saw them. We have some very real evidence that there are sightings, there are visitations. As far as why we haven't seen them, your listener, I've asked myself that question every day. Why can't I see something? Why can't I have direct?
They're holding back for the big one for you, Paula. No doubt about that. Hey, I want to thank you, Paula. Michael, thank you as well. Appreciate both of you being on the program.
Thank you, George.
Okay, you take care. Paula, of course, live from Italy. Michael, somewhere out there in the United States. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasore.